maybe if I open the gain all the way up, I might be able to see some response, but I'm not sure.
Hey, there is a reason for it, John. Despite the fact that I'm operating on low frequencies, and for you it's a lot of fun, John, everything is sooner or later boring if you don't go to the areas where you have a challenge. Don't you think so?
Well, for me, with my small brain, everything's a challenge, but yeah, that's true.
Right. Give me 15 kilohertz. Tell us what you did. Tell us how it works. What you've got. Now, take the comparison, 103 kilohertz. See the difference. That's challenge. Intuition.
Well, I can predict the difference. I don't know the numbers, but the lower the frequency, I'm still going to get some coupling. But now, the coupling port, its effective action as an antenna is going to be minimal. So I will need a lot of gain to be able to see that. And as I go up in frequency, the antenna becomes more of what it's supposed to be.
Right. Well, eventually, we could build a much larger directional coupler and then compare between those two, the NARDA one and the one that you have made.
Well, the only ones I've made are ones of usable length at the frequency I was experimenting with. They worked very well, and Dick was right, because when I terminated the one with the 26-gauge wire with a 50-ohm resistor, I did not check the directivity, but it was coupling beautifully. When I pulled an 18-gauge wire under there, now I had two wires under there. There was a big difference. I had to change the value of the resistance to get the same results. And then I said, well, maybe it's because I still had the 26-gauge wire in there. I pulled that out. That made no difference at all. That was interesting.
Oh yeah, that's. I mean, I have some ideas in regards to directional coupler and electrostatic devices that were promoted by Russian. Before I go there, I mean, it's like all of a sudden I say, hey, I was going around and around, and that might be interesting. I was forcing the idea of electrostatic pump, which actually, despite the fact of the power equation, let me drop it, let's say we're gaining nothing, but we are able just to pump electrons from the ground and to actually.
Well, one thing I can tell you about directional couplers, the ones that I've tested, there is no insertion loss, really. It is minimal. It's measurable, but it's not something you should be concerned with as far as any kind of loss going through the main line. The attenuation on the sample port or the couple port, of course, it's up to the design of the coupler. But I've got a beautiful coupler with 60 dB of coupling. Ooh, beautiful.
And that's why I'm asking you go for the lowest possible frequency, say 15 kilohertz, 20 kilohertz. And I would be so happy if you gave me the results.
Explain that in English?
Well, what I might do is tomorrow, when I set up the experiments, I'll run that through. I'll start at maybe 200 kilohertz, somewhere around there, vary between 100 and 200, and see what I can determine on the spectrum analyzer. And I have a low-frequency spectrum analyzer also. I can try that and see what happens.
Oh, yeah. Now, the station that said, can you explain that in English, please? What is your call sign, sir?
32BU1.
W2BU1. My name is Wesley. What exactly would you like me to explain it in English?
Listen to you guys. I feel like the dumbest radio amateur operator.
No. Don't ever feel like that. Most of the time, we don't know what the hell we're talking about, so don't feel bad.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I'm trying to absorb what you guys are saying, but I don't understand a lot of theory. I am an amateur guy, as you guys put. Jeez, you're talking Chinese to me.
Well, it's just, buzzwords that you haven't heard and things you're not familiar with because you didn't work in that area. But they're not difficult to understand. It depends on, how much listening you do and what you actually do with, like, your spare time, if you do any experimenting or anything like that. But we're always happy to talk to people.
Hey, man, I dig what you guys are talking. I just wish I understood it, some more.
Okay, very good. Well, just keep listening. If you have a question, chime in. KC2WGB.
And to XGM. I believe everything is easy. It's only attention. I had to fight with additional factor, which is language barrier. And not only to understand certain things that I was not in the knowledge of, but also, even though that I know the subject, how to express myself. And it took me a lot of help from mainly John and Dick and Eric and Glenn. Those guys actually helped me out. So there's nothing difficult in it. And it's nothing that is of high-tech stuff that could not be understood if one wants it. John.
KC2WGB. Yeah, if you're talking about the normal use of different instruments and radios and things like that, that's understandable. Where it gets a little strange is when we start talking in the fringe areas where we're not even sure until you do empirical study or testing, and you'll find out things don't always go that way. I find it's fun just exploring to see where we could go and how far.
And now, talking about the direction copper, there is some alternative measure of insulation of direction copper in the directivity, and that would be the insulation in dBs minus the coupling ratio in dBs. So that would be a copper that could be described as high directivity coupler. And it does have a very low ratio of power feed to isolated port from the input port compared to with the power feed to the coupled port from the input port. What actually puzzles me is that just the coefficient of coupling makes the reactivity the power splitting between the direct port and the coupled port. So the performance of direction copper then would be in the insertion loss for the signal passing between the input and port and direct port. But say for the couplers offering a weak coupling between the input port and the coupled port, the insertion loss then is expected to be very low, say 1 to 10. That would be minus 10 dBs at the coupled port. And I assume that will give the rise to the minimum insertion loss. Although you say that the insertion loss is omittable, it still should be below 1 dB, say 0.5, 0.45 dB, to have the relationship between the coupling ratios in dBs. But I would try to, I'm not good in dBs. I was always operating in microvolts. Anyhow, enter XGN.
Yeah, it comes as a surprise. I've measured the loss on most of the ones I have that are about a tenth of a dB, or maybe 0.15. That seems to be the loss from the input to the output port, not the coupling port.
Yeah, so actually, I st- have to pay attention to the relationship between the coupling ratios, minimum insertion loss for the match RF coupler. And I got, when I was looking at some of the literature about the patent, I was trying to understand, because at first when they asked me what is the difference, I was trying to look at what they have in claims, but I couldn't find anything special, so I was just reading BS. But in design of the retro coupler, the critical requirement for high isolation and high directivity is that it should have the even mode impedance of the coupled transmission line with the odd mode impedance, and that would be coupled transmission line that are equal to square of the reference of terminating impedance. I believe I say it right. Just for you to understand where I'm coming from, ladies and gentlemen. Okay, I have the electrostatic pump. That means I'm trying to pump electrons from the ground, whatever frequency it is, whatever. I'm trying to keep the directivity. It means I first create an electrostatic potential. And I'm trying, doesn't matter if I gain something, let's say I gain nothing on it, but I'm trying to use it as a pump. Do you see any application for the electrocoupler? Let's say you have two buckets of water, and then you're using your mouth, you're sucking it, and then you use the gravity to do the rest job for you. So the energy that you use for sucking it is very little comparing to the energy that you don't pay for. And so that would be sort of not the smartest explanation. But do you see any application for the rickshaw coupler if you were to create such a pump? And to see it.
Yeah, there I have no idea why you would want to use a directional coupler and what it would do for you. In that sense, I don't know. I can tell you this much. In the center of its frequency spectrum that it's specified for, those are where I measured those great loss numbers. If you have like a 1 to 2 gigahertz coupler, when you get up to 2 gig, when you start getting up close to 2 gig, you could have a 2 dB loss in that coupler. And when you reach their fringes, that's when you start to notice the losses, especially when you get up in the higher range of the coupler's specifications. But how you would use that with an electrostatic pump, I don't know. I don't even believe that you can develop an electrostatic pump to suck electrons out of the ground, so I wouldn't know how you would use that.
Did I know? I came out with the idea a long time ago. You create the electrostatic potential, and then you're trying to, so one of them is the ground, and the other one is whatever is up there. And then you have the current flow from the ground, say, to whatever is up there, to keep it short. And on its way, it doesn't matter if you have a gain, forget about the gain, so far no gain. Okay. Now you're using an impulse just to push the current flow. But on its own way, you have a coil of the capacitor. You could compare it to the directional coupler. And it's loose coupling. Now, if you have a second coil next to the coil that is one side connected to the ground, so that coil, because of the electromagnetic field, has the current that is on it. So now, to that coil, you're connecting the light bulb, whatever the light bulb is, and you're actually dissipating part of the current that is flowing from the ground. So let's say you have a closed circuit, doesn't matter, closed circuit, what the part of it is the ground. Are you following so far?
Okay. No, not really, because if you're going to draw electrons out of the ground, they have to return to that point after they go through your structure. So you can't just have it come out of the ground and hook to a mysterious thing that doesn't return back. Otherwise, you'll have no current flow. And you cannot have a directional coupler work on DC.
Not work on DC. It's work on ACs. Everything is work on ACs, and I didn't say that we don't have a closed loop. Even in when we were talking about the high voltage and the Cadicellus coils, I remember we had Glenn talking with us. He said, whatever the way the induction would be, whatever the electrostatic field would be, must be the closed circuit and to agree in.
Well, you didn't describe the closed circuit returning it back to ground. You had it coming out of the ground and going to a light bulb, let's say. All right, now, if you took that probe on the other end of the light bulb, stuck it in the ground a distance away, and let's say you had a little LED on there, yeah, you may be able to pick up the difference of potential enough to light that LED. But without returning it to the ground, it's not going to light. Now, if you put an antenna up and you want to pick up static electricity and have a ground rod, and in between that you've got the LED, you'll get flickers on the LED, sure.
Yeah, sure. No, imagine that you have a, for easiness, you have a ground, which is a part of the circuitry. You have a one coil. The coil is connected with one side to the ground, and the other side is connected to the generator. And the other side of the generator is connected to the ground. So the ground is only a part of the circuitry. Now, that coil is a part of the transformer where you have another coil, a coupled coil. And that another coil has a light bulb connected to it. If you have a current flowing through the circuitry, AC1, then of course in the second coil where it has a light bulb on it, you're going to have a voltage. So it would be not an electrostatic pump, there would be a typical circuit. The only difference is that it's using a ground as a part of the circuitry. And to assume.
Yeah, well, what you're describing now makes sense because you've got a ground on one end, goes to the coil goes to the generator, and the generator is going back to ground. So now we have a ground bit. Why do we need the ground? Just connect another wire. So you're not really drawing electrons out of the ground, you're sending them through on the circuit. And yes, if you had a secondary coil, if you had enough current in that primary coil, yeah, you'd get a light to light on the secondary, sure.
Now, we're changing the structure. Now what we're doing is, we are creating a electrostatic potential, and because of that potential, we have a polarization. But when we change the electrostatic potential into the AC, so you have a temporary plus and temporary minus, and then you're changing it. Now you're creating sort of the structure that acts similar way. If you take the Abramenkov work, you see that you have a two diodes only on one wire, and a 500 watt of the light bulb is we had that what is it, halogen light bulb is giving the light, and you have a one wire. That's the Abramenkov work. There is nothing new. We've been there and there's that.
Well, now, I don't know how you're going to take the coil, plug it into the ground, and develop some kind of electrostatic force. Okay, electrostatic force is going to be really DC. All right, how are you going to alternate it from positive to negative? Don't know. And I don't believe that light was lighting at 500 watts with one wire. Impossible, in my opinion.
That's your opinion. We've been through that, we discussed that. Abramenkov work is pretty much known for at least 35 years. And there is nothing new about it. You just Google for it, you find more about it. But I would rather, instead of going to choose the electrostatic pump theory right now, I would rather come back to your question, which was, what is the sense of life? Because that was what actually I found interesting and to actually...
Oh, the existence of reality? Well, you know, that's the universal question for the entire universe. Is what we're seeing or what we're doing, is it real or is it not? Is all of this in our imagination? You know, I don't know. A difficult one. But there is no way you're going to light a 500-watt lamp with a flamingo fork or whatever you want with one wire at its rated power. It's not going to happen.
It is going to happen. It happened. It happened many times. John, it's just... I don't want to go to it. I have a twisted leg and right now, and I have just... I'm a little bit distracted, that's why. But, yes, it is. you just do your experiment, you're gonna see it very, very, very much on your table. Take 100 watts. It's gonna light up. And do it.
Well, I know you believe that. I don't, and I wouldn't waste my time doing it because it's not going to. Now, listen. You get a fluorescent tube and you put it near a Tesla coil, yeah, it'll light, you know, that. Is it drawing that same current? No. You're exciting the phosphor? Yes. But now you're saying a lamp that needs 500 watts. Okay. If you put, what, 1,000,000 volts into it and the air capacitance is going to make it light? Just think about it. It can't happen. You try it on your bench. I'm not going to even bother wasting my time.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, that's the difference. Because you're not going to waste your time. I bet you're going to have it. Just put Avramenko, A-V-R-A-M-E-N-K-O. Avramenko fork. Or Avramenko circuit. Use your Google, you're gonna find thousands of references to it. So, when we're talking about the directional coupler not being pretty much known, although many people use it, we might say the Avramenko fork is not only not known to many, but not many use it. And many of them say, I'm not going to use Avramenko fork because I'm gonna waste my time. Instead of just say, hey, let's try directional coupler and let's try the Avramenko fork and see what's happened. And you see it.
Well, I know the realities of a directional coupler and I know the realities of a 500 watt bulb. And your flamingo fork is not going to do it no matter what. But you say it does, you know, in your lab it works. I wouldn't waste the time on my table. And it's not, you know, I have no interest in it, so it really doesn't appeal to me, even if it does work, but I don't believe it does. I have never seen it, and yes, we had this discussion 2 years ago. I looked at those silly things on YouTube, and I think all of those people are crazy.
Okay, just till you try it by yourself and you find out that it works. You can even talk to Glenn, and he would say, Avramenko, not Flamenco, Avramenko fork works. You would say that. I saw it. I did it. I'm going to have it. I'm going to find out where did I put it. And I believe that the halogen light bulb that I have is still about 300 watts. And it's going to work. On one wire, only. And to XGN.
Light it up.
Okay, one wire, it worked. And don't put words in Glenn's mouth. I don't think he'd like that. I don't know what his opinion is. And he can have his opinion too, of course. Like guys, most people have.
I got a question for the machine.
Go ahead.
where is this machine? Say again?
What machine are you talking about?
Whatever machine I'm keying right now.
It's on the borderline of Queens and Suffolk County in Long Island.
Okay, watch that. Okay, look. I'm a great distance from you guys. Put a little mobile radio, short of time.
Okay, yeah, you got quite a hum there, too, on that radio. But, you're making it.
I'm getting a hum, from everybody out there that's keyed up. Yep. I'm running a small power supply. I should run into my bank, but yeah, I'll fix that.
Okay, yeah, I'm sure if you fix that, it'll sound a lot better. Yes?
Okay. John, what I could do is easy way. I tried to find what I have that Aramco work and come to you, show you in your own eyes. Because I can't believe, John. Nothing new. And to see it.
Nah, that's all right. I don't want to see it. It's silly. It doesn't benefit me at all to see something that I don't think can work. If it works, fine. I don't believe it does, but I don't need it to be shown to me. I have no interest in it.
John, I don't understand that. Look, at first you say it doesn't work, and I say it works. At second you say, even if it works, I don't want to see it. What's wrong with seeing it?
Well, it doesn't help me with the experiments that I do. Not that I don't want to be educated, it's just that I want to be educated in different areas. That is, whether it works or not, doesn't mean anything to me. It means something to you because you're working in that area and you believe in some of the hocus pocus and you believe in some of the facts that they're showing and all these brilliant people that design this stuff. But where is it used in industry today? Right now, where is its major application?
That's a good question. Honestly, I don't know.
Okay, QED.
It's not QED. Well, I'm trying to right now to find the Wikipedia explanation for it.
Wes, don't waste your time. You know, when you read from that Wikipedia crap, I don't enjoy that. You know, I like to hear your interpretations of the things that are common between us. And this is not something common, you know. It's something you believe in, and you say you've done it, you've seen it, and everybody's using them or whatever. That's fine, I believe that.
Yeah, I could go to it and try to explain that. The only thing is that I'm totally distracted today. I mean, I would like to keep the conversation easy. You are, John, a tough subject. Somebody who makes a fool out of you is really talented. But at the same time, if something is not often present, you take it with a lot of resistance, which is a good. At least nobody's going to poison you. And to agree.
Stupid people do stupid things, and smart people outsmart each other.
Well, I can be fooled very easily. It's not difficult to do. And I know the Flamingo fork with its spark gap and the capacitors, and I don't remember the diagram exactly verbatim, but I have a good idea, and I don't see any magic in that feeding one wire to a bulb and having the bulb light at its rating. If it's 500 watts and it's got 5 amps at 100 volts, okay, fine. That isn't going to happen.
It is going to happen. At first you have to have a presence of the high voltage. And then you're going to have two diodes. The two diodes are connected together. One is one way and the other one is reverse way. They're being fitted to the high voltage wire from the transformer. One side of the transformer can, but doesn't have to be, connected to the ground. And now that a halogen 500 watts, say, is connected to nowhere, it's connected only between those two legs of those two diodes. And it's not Flamenco, it's Avramenco, and to XGN.
E3JIW from Toronto.
Go ahead, please.
This is Victor Echo 3 Juliet India Whiskey from Toronto. Good morning.
Good morning. I believe it's Jim. It's John, KC2WGB.
Well, good morning. Good morning and good morning. I had... Could I slightly change the subject to a device that a friend of mine showed me that I could not make sense of? And it's something that... could I describe the device and you can tell me if you've ever heard of it? Or is it, have I picked a bad time?
Oh, right ahead. We're open for anything, sure. Go ahead, Jim.
Well, this thing is sealed, so I couldn't open it up to see what's in it, but it's a short piece of power cord to a standard 2x4 cast box with a standard outlet on the front. And it does something with the power. Anyway, so I hook up a resistive load electric heater on 750 watts. And I plug the heater in normally, and my ammeter shows me 7 amps, 6.5 amps. But when I plug into this device, my same current meter reads 0 amps, and the heater's running. Now, it's doing something with the waveform. They're apparently designed to play with stop hydrometers from reading your draw. I don't know what's in it. I checked my meter. I could not get a current reading. When I ran it through a power bar with a circuit breaker, when I went to 3 heaters on 750 watts, it tripped the fuse. Have you ever seen or heard of any of these devices? Somebody's making these. I don't know what they're called.
Possibly it could be some kind of switch mode power supply, but let me ask you something. Did you check the current on the secondary load to the heater and also on the primary where it's plugged in?
No. I can do that now. I still have it, but I was interested in the current feeding this device. I don't know how the heater can be running, and that how it's an RMS AC volt, that true RMS AC volt current stop, a decent quality meter, but I couldn't understand how the heater can work. I'm plugged into the mains, and I can't read the current.
Well, let me ask you, did you measure the AC voltage on that adapter that you have it plugged into? A resistive heater will run on DC.
Well, I'm not sure if the muffin fan that runs it will run. No, I was reading front coming out of the wall. That's right. If I was seeing half the wave, my meter would see zero on the other way, and it would sit. That's an interesting question. I don't know. I've now got the meter and the device and an oscilloscope at home, so I can actually see what's happening. But you've never heard. Have you ever heard of these devices? They might be things that don't work and they're sold to people. You know, you hook them up and you don't pay for the power you're using.
I've heard of some of those devices. I've never seen one or did any testing with one. I've heard of them. Whether they work or not, I don't know. But it's an interesting thing. It is working, and you can't measure any current. And it is putting out the heat. Obviously, at the rated voltage, you can usually tell if it's even close. So you've got an interesting conundrum there, that's for sure.
Not getting free energy. But now since then I've got a much more accurate, I'm getting a new hydrometer, it'll be accurate maybe. And since I do, you know, it's good weather to be running a heater. By the way, we're getting near for freezing, no snow. We had some rain. I saw a little bit of water that was collected, had frozen ice from last night, but still okay weather. And just finished outside with my nephew doing a water pump on his car at 12:30, well, midnight. Probably we tidied up, but still not miserable.
Jim, let me ask you something. Your electric power meter, the kilowatt hour meter, is it a digital one or does it have the rotating disc in it?
We now get the digital ones, and I think they use either BPL or Wi-Fi for meter reading. It is the digital one. I can tell you that up north, the digital one, it looks the same as the one in the city. They fly a helicopter over the place to read the meter. And no, it isn't a guy on a ladder coming down with the binoculars. It's the radio receiver over the meter. But I still don't know if it's Wi-Fi. I think it's Wi-Fi. The reason I think it's Wi-Fi, I see a really strong Wi-Fi signal at my cottage. And nothing I have plugged in.
Okay, I don't need the resolution of the counters. I don't know what it goes down to on your meter. But turn everything else off. Plug that into a local outlet near the meter with everything else off. Turn your heater on. See if those numbers change after a few minutes of running.
That's exactly what I want to do. I didn't see much difference when I tried it up north, and I wondered if you had to have neighbors on the same transformer. Versus me alone up north, there might not be a difference. That's where I thought the wrinkle might be. I am going to do that testing, and a perfect time to do it because I have minimal stuff hooked up at home. I got a new panel, but I haven't livened up much of my house. And yeah, I could shut everything else off very easily.
Great. Okay, perform that test and let us know how you make out. It's a very interesting thing you have there.
Well, the other one is I have some decimal resistors. So I could put a decimal resistor in series that doesn't drastically drop the load. I used one to try and get a reading for how much current I was driving with the clock. I couldn't get a reading for the clock radio of how much current. And I really gave up trying because I realized that the clock radio wasn't going to really drag down my battery to my UPS, so it didn't really matter. But if I was drawing an amp, I have resistors I could use, so I'm not dealing with the resistor on the meter, I'm not dealing with the circuit or the internal meter. I can do strictly voltage drop over a resistor. Now that still should, I would expect a reading, but I don't know what's going to happen because I really thought when you put a meter on current, you're reading voltage over a fixed load.
Yeah, if you had something like a half ohm or a 1 ohm resistor, you should be able to determine what kind of current you got going through that. If that thing is running in any condition, there's got to be some voltage drop on that resistor. And maybe it will save you money, but I don't know. But that's your next thing. But also, if it's supposed to save you money, that means your electric meter, that kilowatt hour meter, should not be turning. That's a definite proof. So maybe you don't have to go that far with the resistor and stuff. Just leave it running for, 20 minutes at 7 kW. That thing should be turning.
The heater's going to be decimal 7. And realize this is a fairly heavy power cord and outlet, but I don't want to leave it running at full 1500. I don't think the wires inside might be heavy enough. I don't know what the guy did. A friend of mine wanted to cut one apart. They're his, so he hadn't. Yeah, I will do as much testing as I think of, and I think safely connecting the oscilloscope and looking at the waveform would be interesting. Same as those, remember we had discussion on the night about those battery tender savers? Scott and ZTZ sold me two of his. And, well, be perfect to hook up a battery and then see what else is coming out on the scope.
Yeah, the scope could be revealing and see if you have a standard waveform or something that's really crazy, which might cause errors in the meter. Not sure. But, let us know how you make out.
Right, and government agency said they get people coming in with science ideas every so often. I believe that if there was a free energy device right now, the solar and wind power people would buy it up to own it. Years ago, if somebody created any great device, the car companies or the gas companies would buy it up. And my memory's not that good, but remember pre-73, oil was like $3 or $5 or $8 a barrel? Couldn't believe that. Though I was around at the time, so I think if any of these comes out, do come out as viable, they'll be bought up by the people who don't want to give up their existing business model.
I think that they would attempt to do that, sure, if it's a legitimate item and it really works. I mean, not saving you 3 or 5%, if it starts reducing it substantially, even if it's not zero. Yeah, I believe they tried.
Last other question. What year do you think directional couplers were invented, or the technology was discovered?
Well, excellent question. If I'm not mistaken, I think they were being used in the 40s, late 40s. But that's a good question for Dick. I'm sure he'd know.
That you could pick some of the smartest amateur radio people prior to that. And I mean, I sort of understand the operation of a directional. The purpose of a directional coupler, my understanding is you feed RF in one, antenna out the other, dummy load on the return. Reflected power doesn't go back to the transmitter. It goes to that dummy load. That is my understanding of a directional coupler.
Well, if you were to look at the directional coupler and you put a generated signal into it, you put a dummy load at the other end, there would be no reflected power. You would see minimal on the coupled port. If you took the terminator off, now you would have a return flow because the impedance matches bad. So now whatever's going out that coupler is going to go right back because it's an open circuit. So that's basically how they work.
For someone who understands DC and the working of a flashlight, do you think that directional coupler is employing black magic to do what it does? Because when you first hear about it, it doesn't make sense to people who understand how a DC circuit works. I'm not saying they don't work, I'm just saying that they're an amazing device. They're fragile. They probably have to be tuned. We have them at the repeater site. I've looked at them, but I haven't monkeyed with them.
Well, when you get a chance, take one home and use a signal generator and some different matching networks, like a 50-ohm load, maybe a 75 if you have it. And when you're working in the 50-ohm world and you start putting different terminators on there, you're going to see the reflected information coming out of that coupled port.
Thank you for visiting the Long Island Local Amateur Radio Club repeater system. Node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
KC2QIQ.
Hey, Glenn. Good evening. Again.
Yeah, good morning. I caught a little bit of the conversation earlier, but I was trying to get to sleep, and now I just can't get to sleep unless I say something. But you were talking about a device where you plug it into the wall with a kilowatt meter, and can you make a power meter actually measure that no power at all? And the answer to that one is yes, you definitely can. There's definitely ways of doing that. KC2QIQ.
Well, that's what Jim from Toronto is asking. He has a box in his possession that the heater runs, but it's supposedly not to let the kilowatt hour meter move at all.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, just like what you're doing is it really just messes up the power factor. What you do is basically, in some instances, you have certain things like computers and certain DC power supplies. There are devices that you can use that fix the power factor, that make the power factor 1 in AC circuits. You know, it's volts times amps times the cosine the phase angle between the voltage and the current. Now, the thing is, when they're in phase, the power meter reads full output power of volts and amps. But you can also make devices that will do the exact opposite, so that you get full power across the load, but the current and the voltage going back to the power meter are, you're still drawing the voltage and the current, they're just out of phase, and the power meter can't resolve a poor power factor. So basically what's happening is you're reading very, very low or no power at all, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, That's why industrial plants have to maintain a power factor correction, capacitors and stuff like that. But individual homeowners on a single phase, not sure. Okay. Well, if you say it's possible, you know better than I do.
Well, it's not that it's not possible. It's perfectly, I mean, you know, if you design something that messes up the power factor going back to the power meter, yeah, the power meter won't read anything. But here's the kicker, though. Let's say if you do enough of this, let's say if you put enough of these circuits in your house so that you drop your electric bill to, like, half, what's going to happen is the power company is going to look at your consumption and say, well, you know, hey, this guy used to pay $200 a month in electric, and now they're down to, like, $60 a month in electric. So what they'll do is they'll come out, they'll check your power meter because your consumption went down, and they're going to look and see if you're still drawing power. And then what they'll do is they'll actually put, you know, a clamp on the power line to see if you're drawing volts and amps. If you're drawing volts and amps and the power factor's bad, what they'll do is they're going to slap a demand meter on your house, and then your electric bill will, if you thought your electric bill was high before, wait till you see what happens when you pay for VA, KC2-QIQ.
But that's only higher if you trip the demand. It might be lower. That's why they don't want to put them in.
No, demand meter, John, is always higher. It's always higher because you're paying for VA. You're not paying for RMS power.
Well, what you find is if you don't have any high current starts, it doesn't trip the demand key. So therefore, the demand factor that you use for multiplication doesn't apply. It's zero.
Yeah, that's not really how it works. What's actually happening is when you have bad power factor, your voltage and current is higher than it normally would be. Because when you look at power factor, when volts and amps are in phase, you're drawing true RMS power, and the volts, the peak voltages and the peak currents are in, you know, they're in proportion to the power that you're using. But when the power factor is bad, the voltage and the current is very, very much larger, but out of phase in order to supply that load. So, yeah, you're going to kick the demand. There's no question about that. KC2QIQ.
Yeah, and to exceed also.
Yes, Clint, you're right in that case. What I was saying, if you were to take your regular home meter where your demand factor wouldn't be tripped and have that replaced with a power factor meter, I mean a demand meter, your bill would go down, believe it or not. It's happened in a couple of industrial sites. And they put the other meter back in. But you're right, being that he has those devices... Yeah, now it's going to be disproportional. Yeah, that demand meter would probably trip.
Yeah, and, you know, this has happened in different places where, you know, people have thought, oh, we'll get around the power company. And what they don't realize is that the power company really doesn't monitor the power nearly as much as they monitor the billing. And computers will, you know, flag that kind of stuff left and right. It's all of a sudden, you know, the house is still occupied, and all of a sudden your bill drops by a dramatic amount. They're immediately going to send somebody out to check the meter because they're going to expect a broken meter. And if the meter's good, and the demand, you know, that you're still pulling power, then they will check the VA on the line. And if they do spot that your power factor's really, really bad, enough to knock your power, you will get a demand meter, or they'll change the meter on the house. There are other instances. Let me let it drop for a second.
And you need what I have, the demand meter key.
You got to reset it. But what happens, though, John, is that I've heard some people do this one, where they've taken electric heat, and they put electric heat in the house that normally was oil, you know, oil heat. And they still have the oil heat, but they put in an electric heat system. And what they've done is they've augmented circuits like that really mess up the power factor bad. But what happens is they're still using the same, like, you know, power for their lighting and their... you know, for all the other things, so their bill, electric bill, relatively remains constant. But when they kick on the electric heat, the bill is still about the same, so it doesn't change. Where normally their bill would be four times higher when an electric heat, but they don't have it. But the oil company now isn't supplying the oil as much anymore, so the oil goes way, way, way down. They're basically getting the electric for the electric heat system, basically for free, and nobody knows the difference. Other than the power company, the oil company realizes that they're not delivering as much oil anymore. KC2QIQ.
Yeah, okay, and they'll probably rat you out just to get even. Let's pick it up.
That's just it. They just realize that they're not delivering oil. So it doesn't cost them anything other than just, you know, you're not using the oil. And the power company isn't going to flag it because they don't, you're still paying the same electric bill every month. KC2QIQ. Wesley, it's over to you.
Thank you very much. Glenn, thanks for being with us. I have a question for you. You probably heard about Avramenko fork, which actually, from one side, you have, let's say, 8 megahertz square wave oscillator. And then you have a wire that goes to two diodes. One of them is straight, the other one is forward. So the two ends of those two diodes are connected to this wire. Now, at the other ends of those two diodes, you put the load, and you're gonna have a current flow. So let's say you put the light bulb on it, and for some reason, John says, "Well, that Avramenko stuff doesn't work. It is only a transmission over one wire, so nothing special in it." Enter Adrian.
Third circuits work, Leslie. What they are, they're E-field generators. They're very, very similar to the same effect. Have you ever seen a Van de Graaff generator where somebody generates high voltage and you stand on an isolated stool, like a wooden stool, and you watch the girls there stand straight up, but E-field actually will lift. And to actually do work, it will lift the girl's hair up on her head. Have you seen that before?
Of course I did.
Well, here again, you can do a certain amount of work with high E-fields. You can stir oil and create turbulent oil flow with high E-fields. You can light light bulbs. You can lift girls' hair standing on an isolated chair. There are many, many things you can do with high E-fields. The downside with high E-fields is that when they're in the static state, like when the girl's hair is standing up in the air or the light bulb is being lit, it's relatively inert. In other words, you won't damage too many things. But the problem is, in a home application or a lighting application, when you turn the E-field on or off, or like when the girl stands off the chair, she has to be discharged. And what happens when she gets discharged, Wesley?
Well, she gets shocked.
Right on. In other words, you're discharging a large E-field, so you're going to get a large static discharge. And this is the major problem with that technology, is that it creates EMP. In other words, if you're going to create E-fields large enough to light light bulbs and power circuits where that really use power, you have to energize the E-field. And in doing so, if you've got nice electronic circuits and cell phones and other things around, you're going to destroy all those little transistors in there, because not only is the E-field going to light the light bulb, that E-field is going to go into little transistors and receivers, and it'll literally tear all the little transistors apart. So every time you turn, and it happens when you turn it on and when you turn it off. So when you make and break very, very large E-fields that are going to do real work and real power, it really does, it becomes quite destructive, and that's really the downside of that sort of thing. So it's kind of frowned upon. KC2QIQ.
That's right. So that's what I was trying to say to John. There was all, I've been playing with that. I was fortunate to not break anything, but I was having a light bulb that was connected to the ends of it, and there was tungsten base, and actually there was a halogen of it. It was working pretty nice. Now, one of the experiments that was made was actually 8 megahertz square wave oscillator that had only 5 volts in the amplitude, but then it does have a thin PVC pipe, and the wire was winded on it, so there was no other wire at all. It was not like a Tesla coil that we were dealing with it, two coils. And at the end of it, you had those two diodes and the load. Load wasn't the big one, but it was leading pretty well, as it was in the tungsten base. And to actually...
Well, keep in mind, the idea behind the Tesla coil is you're building up a DC charge, you know, charging current, and then you're releasing it. And that's basically why you need a very, very large coil to create the voltage step up. But as you increase frequency, as you know yourself, your antennas get smaller, transformers get smaller, everything gets smaller. So although it doesn't look like that you've got a big coil there, as you increase frequency, the electromagnetics become much smaller, so it doesn't look the same. That's the only difference there was. In case 2QIQ, the effect is the same.
Thank you very much for that explanation, John Pickup.
Well, like I said, if you put enough voltage on that 500-watt bulb, you're going to get it to glow. You are not going to get 500 watts out of your flamingo fork. I don't care what you do with it, unless you build something huge. That's a lot of power. I don't think you're going to get a 500-watt bulb to work.
You do. And it's not really flamingo, it's abramenco. And 500 watts, halogen light bulb was leading very nice. I don't know if it was dissipating 500 watts that I cannot tell you, but it was pretty bright, Glenn.
You told me it was putting out its rated wattage. You said it was glowing at 500 watts. Okay. I wonder if it was as hot as it should have been.
Yeah, the hot was. It was. The hot it was. Was it exactly 500 watts or 400 watts? I cannot say it, but it was pretty much nicely glowing. Glenn, pick up.
Sure, I mean, it's possible. I mean, you can create a large enough E-field to energize just about whatever you want. I mean, you can cause E-fields large enough to... I mean, if you create a large enough E-field, you could levitate a car. And does it have to be super, super large? Well, here again, you just make sure that the frequency generator of it is at a high... I mean, heck, you could do like 8 megahertz, like the other gentleman did, and, you know, you can shrink things down quite a bit. And it doesn't have to be RF frequencies. I mean, they could be, you know, middle HF frequencies, and you can create these large E-fields too. So, I mean, there's a lot of ways of creating large E-fields. The problem is that, especially today with modern electronics, that, you know, especially if whatever the distance is to your load, anything in between, that E-field path is basically going to see it as a big EMP. And, I mean, you're going to blow out your TVs, your radios, your cell phones, I mean, everything. And it's not when it's stable. When it's stable and it's lighting, you could walk right through an E-field as long as you don't disturb it. And it'll continue to light the light bulb and not use a tremendous amount of energy to do it. But the problem is when you energize it and you discharge it, that's when all the damage takes place. And I mean, when I tell you, you'd be replacing every form of electronics in your house if you use circuits like that. KC2QIQ.
KC2WGB. Well, that's what I asked Wesley. I said, listen, if this flamingo fork is so magical and so wonderful, where is it used in industry or commercially or residentially? Where is it? What is it used for? So if it's worthless, it's worthless.
No, that I didn't argue with you. I actually agreed to you that I don't know of any commercial application for it, unless we talk about voltage doublers, maybe something in this, or a sparking device. Instead of load, you can actually have a spark up, and you will see that the spark will build in between them, but then you might lose your diode. But anyhow, the generator that was made at that time was just a small flyback from the old TV. That was enough, and to actually...
Well, like everything else, too, flybacks are interesting circuits, but if you keep on increasing the frequency on them, and you've got a switch, you know, a transistor, that basically can switch at a high enough frequency, and you work with the ratios, the impedance ratios between the flyback transformer and a coil, you can generate some pretty serious voltages. I did an experiment like that in my backyard about 2 or 3 summers ago, and I generated a near lightning storm in my backyard. It was quite impressive.
Oh, yeah, that I agree with, because, it's like working with a Tesla coil that's 100,000 volts or 1,000,000 volts, but it's great to study